Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Can I have your attention, please? Can I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please? I'd like to make just a few announcements before we begin. As I said before, my name's Jim Atwood, and I'm president of the Harvard Law School Forum, and I welcome you to the forum. We have been spending the better part of 36 years bringing discussion to this campus. And I think we've succeeded in doing that today. Let me make two announcements before we begin. First, a late-breaking bulletin for us. On Wednesday, November 30th, in the afternoon at 3 o'clock, we will be hosting Senator Alan Cranston. Senator Cranston will be appearing in the Ames courtroom, located in a law school campus, and he will be delivering a major policy address. On Monday, December 5th, we are pleased to announce that we have rescheduled the appearance of Mr. Shimon Peres, the chairman of the Israel Labor Party. That will take place at 1 p.m., also in the Ames courtroom on the law school campus. As I mentioned before, the format of today's program allows for a question and answer period following the secretary's remarks. We have two microphones on the floor. We will have two forum members at each microphone, and we would request, once we get to the Q&A period, that you line up behind the microphones, and we will take them in alternate order. I emphasize at this point, questions should be brief, concise, and to the point. It is a question and answer period. Let me now turn over the microphone to Roger Fisher, the Samuel Williston Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, who will introduce this afternoon's most distinguished guest and alumnus. Thank you.
A few minutes ago, when at lunch, one of my colleagues heard I was going to introduce our speaker. Knowing my views on our military policy and foreign policy, knowing the views, he said, "Boy," knowing what we might expect here, he said, "Boy, have you got a problem?" When I heard that, I was reminded of the last time I worked full time for the Pentagon as a weather observer in World War II. We were test flying a plane over Newfoundland. One engine was new. The hotshot pilot feathered three engines to see how it would do on one engine. And we were all duly impressed. That is, scared to death. And just for a lark, he then feathered the fourth engine. Now that really is impressive. The airplane was gliding somewhat like a rock toward the hills of Newfoundland. As we were wondering what in hell to do, the pilot confidently came over and pushed the buttons to refeather the blades back into the wind, and nothing happened. He started pushing every button in the plane, and only then did he remember that you couldn't refeather the engines without power, and you had no power unless you had one engine going. Well, as we were all getting our chutes on, the co-pilot burst out laughing. He turned to him and said, "Boy, oh boy, have you got a problem?" Well, We're in this together. We're in the whole world situation together, and this afternoon we're in this together. We've invited a distinguished guest here. Those of us who disagree with his policies on occasion believe that they should be, please, Every interruption is going to give us less chance to get our questions. I've got some questions I want to ask. I know you have questions you want to ask. There are some people who take a physical approach. And those of us who are critical... Those of us who believe that ideas should compete with ideas, we cannot deal in Grenada with locking up people in detention. We cannot prevent ideas by shutting them up physically.
Genocide is not an idea!
This occasion is one for us to hear and ask questions. I'm asking you, Our guest was class of 1938 in the college, class of 41, the law school. He served in the infantry from private to captain. He went back to California where he practiced law for a number of years, maybe 20. And then he was in the state legislature, head of the California's Commission on State Government, the little Hoover Commission. He then came to Washington, first as Federal Trade Commission, then with the Office of Management and Budget, where he became Deputy Director and Director, Secretary of HEW, back to business, where he was with California, where he was briefed for a few years with Bechtel, and since 1981, he has been the Secretary of Defense. I ask you to let's get the ideas by shouting that if the only one who will win this afternoon, if you think you can win this thing, the only one who will win if he's prevented from speaking are the people who believe that force and violence should decide these questions, not ideas. I ask you to hear ideas.
That I have says that it is always a great pleasure to be invited back to Harvard, as indeed it is. Good. Now, you have a message, obviously. You have a message which you'd like me to hear, or some of you do, and I have a message that I would like you to hear. And I think in the time allotted, we can get together and both hear each other's messages and each other's answers. And the message that I have is that arms reduction, genuine, deep, verifiable, and equitable arms reduction is a cornerstone, a keystone of our whole administration policy. What it is we are seeking are real results, not just negotiations, not just noise, and not just an agreement that can be signed, but we have to be very concerned about its contents, because its contents is the critical thing. So what we seek is a genuine, a negotiated...
Most of us here would like to exchange this few moments. You can protest and demonstrate outside, you can raise signs. There's a few minutes to hear some ideas, a few minutes to ask questions. Secretary's speech, let's let him say what he wants to say, and then let's ask him questions. That's what Harvard is about.
All right. There we go. I used to come here quite frequently when I was a student to hear the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and they always sounded, if I may say so, a great deal better than what we're hearing. But what we seek is a genuine and negotiated peace. We seek a reduction, an actual reduction, not just a limitation agreement, but actual reduction to equal level. And it is essential that we get down to equal levels if we are to reduce the fear and the terror that a great many of these weapons have brought. I think it's worth thinking back to the dawn of the nuclear age. At the dawn of the nuclear age, the United States found itself with a complete and total monopoly of these weapons. We were, at that time, with unquestioned military superiority, had it in our power to hold it, blackmail, if we wished, the world, and we did not do that. We pursued an exactly opposite course. What we did was to recognize that there could be no winners in a nuclear war, and we offered to turn over our knowledge of nuclear power to an international agency. That was the Baruch Plan, and it is one of the first of the many plans that were offered and proposals that were offered to reduce the impact of these weapons. But it is also a keystone of our policy to try to keep the peace. And we are convinced that the only way in which the peace can be kept, we are convinced that the only way the peace can be kept is by a twin course of trying to secure genuine and verifiable and sharp arms reductions at the same time that we maintain sufficient strength to encourage the other side to participate in negotiations of that kind. We've recognized that there can be no winners in a nuclear war, and we have recognized that a nuclear war should never be fought, and we have recognized that the twin factors that can produce a peace with freedom, a peace with freedom to say the things that we wish to say, is a posture of deterrence, which has both deterrence, and that is maintenance of sufficient degree of strength so that position will always be clear, that we cannot have a strike made against us without a degree of retaliatory strength that would prevent the first strike from being made. And it is that degree of strength that we have to have that we think can prevent a nuclear confrontation. We think that if we do not have that twin policy of maintaining sufficient strength and modernization to deter attack, and at the same time try to secure that reduction of weapons that can enable us to have the balance of deterrence at much lower levels than at present, that then we will have the very best chance for preserving our peace with freedom. But maintaining that credible deterrent requires us to upgrade our own forces if our adversaries upgrade theirs. And even though we have no offensive intentions, and even though we have no desire for peace,
May I have your attention, please? May I remind those people who are interrupting, may I remind you that if you have any values, if you disagree with some issues, the question I put to you.
That's quite enough, I think. Now they'll listen. The point is that maintaining a credible deterrent requires that you maintain a degree of strength that can, in fact, deter attack. And it is essential that we have that if the attack is to be deterred. But it is also essential that you maintain that degree of deterrent at the lowest possible level. And that is what we think is essential. It's a paradox, actually, of deterrence, that the longer it succeeds, the less necessary it appears. You can measure these things quite easily in other areas. The cost of maintaining a strong defense are very easily measured. But the benefits of doing that are not. When we spend our money on a new car or a new home, you can see a tangible good. You can measure that. But when you spend your money on various things that are necessary to maintain deterrence, you can never really measure how much aggression has been deterred. If the peace is maintained, people tend to feel that it isn't deterrence, it's some other factor that is doing it. So it is the paradox of deterrence that the more it succeeds, the less necessary it appears. And as the time passes, the maintenance of peace is attributed not to that strong defense you're maintaining, but to all manner of other factors, such as possibly a peaceful intent of the other side, or a spirit of detente, or something of the kind. Now, as people came to doubt that credible nuclear forces have prevented nuclear war, they also can come to believe that a nuclear war is inevitable. And when that happens, then we have really lost all chance of peace. And so, the main thing is to ensure the principal objective and goal, then, of any policy has to be that you have to achieve real arms reduction at the same time you're maintaining sufficient strength to keep the other side at the table with an incentive for induction. If they see that the United States has no intention of strengthening or modernizing its forces, there is no incentive for them to reduce. And without reduction, then you do indeed have the arms race that we are trying to avoid. So it is absolutely essential that we provide that kind, absolutely essential that we provide that kind of incentive for major reduction. Now, during the 70s, we tried a different tack, and unfortunately, it didn't work. We tried in the 70s to restrict our developments of nuclear weapons so that there would be no conceivable suggestion that the Soviet Union would have any idea that they might be struck with a sudden disarming first strike. We had hoped to encourage similar restraint by the Soviets, but unfortunately we did not. Instead of joining us in restraint, what they did was to step up their own strategic modernization program. They developed a whole new generation of ICBMs. They had hardening of their own silos. They spent a lot of money on civil defense. And they also developed something that we do not have and have never had, and that is a refiring capability, so that the mere counts of missiles and warheads becomes increasingly less relevant. And that all led, with their writings and their doctrine and their all of their speeches that they deliver, led to a clear conclusion that they believe a nuclear war can be won, and we do not. We think that it is the most dangerous thing in the world if you think it can be. We pinned high hopes in these arms limitation discussions at Salt. In 1969, when the Soviet began the discussions with Salt One, they had over 1,500 nuclear weapons. In 1972, when Salt One was signed, they had gone up to 2,300. In 1979, they had 5,500. Today, they have over 8,000. And with their arsenal now under the Salt Treaty, and here is the reason that we oppose a SALT treaty, or an arms limitation treaty, because their 8,000 strategic weapons can actually grow to 15,000 under SALT. And so a arms limitation treaty is not enough, it is an arms reduction treaty that is required. And that's why it was so critically important that two weeks ago at Ottawa, with the NATO defense ministers, we agreed to take out 1,400 of these weapons unilaterally, and that was on top of 1,000 that we had taken out earlier, making a total of 24. So our arsenals have gone steadily down, and what we have not done, however, what we have not done is, and on the intermediate range weapons, bear in mind that the president's proposal that he made a year and a half ago is still the best, and that is for zero, none on either side. And unfortunately, the Soviets have declined to discuss that in any way. And then we have tried various other levels to get them down to equality at lower levels than the 351 SS-20s they have now. But unfortunately, they have not yet started to negotiate seriously. Now, the way that we have to modernize has been pointed out quite clearly by the bipartisan commission, the Scowcroft Commission, who said that the modernization was essential at the same time that we continue to press as seriously and as vigorously as we are for arms reduction, major, verifiable, equitable arms reduction. The Scowcroft Commission's proposals were that we stay with the modernization program, that we make sure that we get rid of the most destabilizing weapons of all, and that we modernize our triad, but at the same time that we make every effort and continue to make every effort to secure major and verifiable reductions. And the president has said, and this is important, this is a... I think this is a statement of the, the important thing here is, a statement of the president that I wanted to have before you so you could have it for your thoughtful consideration the rest of the afternoon, and that is that the United States, said the president, will accept any equitable, any verifiable agreement that stabilizes forces at lower levels than currently exist. We want significant reductions, and that pledge stands. Now, the most recent START initiative that the president has before the negotiators at Geneva is one that provides for a mutual and a guaranteed build down of both ballistic missiles and of bombers. We have also proposed the establishment of a joint United States-Soviet build down group. And finally, we continue to try to reduce the destructive capability of these weapons, sometimes called throw weight. And bear in mind that the ratio of throw weight now is something like 5.3 on the Soviet side to 1.9 on the United States side. And so it is essential that we do get there. The president is perfectly willing to enter into negotiations. He said many times there will have to be trade-offs. And he said that the United States is prepared to make these trade-offs so long as they result in a more stable balance of forces. In the short term, he said, stability requires that the Soviet monopoly on their ability to destroy hardened targets has to be ended. And with the INF proposals, where they have a total monopoly, with 351 and more of the SS-20s to none on the NATO side, it is essential that we get down to zero if we can. If they won't accept zero, then down to some much lower level than we have at the moment. And in the cause of, in the whole cause of securing peace, we have to bear in mind that deterrence, while it has certain unpopular aspects, as is quite apparent, is the policy that has helped preserve the peace for nearly 40 years between the superpowers. The other thing, one of the final points that I want to get before you, because I think it's particularly apt today, is that it is very easy. It is very easy to become discouraged with the bipartisan or the democratic processes that are needed. Bear in mind that there is no public opinion in the Soviet Union that would enable us to have a meeting such as this, and there is no way that they can have a rational or even an irrational debate. And so it is essential that we bear in mind that the important thing is to decide all these matters within our democratic process that permits this kind of a discussion. We have spent a lot of time arriving at the positions. We spent a lot of time arriving at the positions that our negotiators are presenting at Geneva, at both the intermediate range and in the long range weapon. And that time has been involved in what a lot of people who get discouraged quickly have said is negotiating with ourselves. And they say that weakens us. And they call attention to the fact that the Soviet Union, there is not only no negotiation with themselves, there is no public opinion. And my own feeling is that negotiating with ourselves is probably a pretty good way of defining democracy. The development of our strategic arms reduction policy has really been an example of democracy at its best. We had a large number of people participate. We had our Defense Department, we had the Scowcroft Commission, we had members of both parties in the Congress, and men and women around the country who have engaged in debates such as this, and some not quite such as this, and all have done their country, I think, a substantial service, because we've had an opportunity to have a very wide number of views, not all of which, of course, can be accepted. About having restored the bipartisan consensus that the Congress has recently exhibited just this week, we must now, I think, have the patience and the will to continue to work together to try to maintain the course on these two parallel paths to peace: sharp arms reduction and yet the modernization that is necessary to maintain deterrence. In the longer run, there is perhaps an even better way. And the longer run is, of course, to work very carefully on strategic defenses that can render all of these weapons impotent and no longer a threat to the world. And this is a path, this is also the path that the President has tried to pursue in calling for weapons that not of destruction, but weapons of defense. He has summoned the best of the scientific genius in this country to try to produce the means of protecting our people and not avenging them. And in the long run, strategic defense offers the greatest hope of removing this shadow from the world. But that is a hope that we can only realize if we can maintain peace with freedom during the time it takes to develop it. And the way of maintaining peace with freedom is through continued, patient, resolute efforts to reduce arms at the same time that we engage in the modernization of our weapons so that we can maintain a credible deterrent balance, and then try to get that balance at infinitely lower level. Now, I believe we can succeed, and I think that to succeed, we have to justify and show a unity of purpose and our patience and our will and our real belief in a truly democratic process that allows these matters to be debated rationally all over the country. Because it seems to me that we have to bear in mind that the goal is nothing less than survival and peace with freedom. Thank you very much. Now, we'll talk to you soon. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. Thank you. Thank you. All right.
Would you please sit down and take your seats?
Thank you very much. Now we can get some... Let's get some questions now. On an individual basis.
Would you, in view of the noise level, the interference with your speaking, would you please write out a card and give it sufficiently under control there? All right. Now, it is important for the majority to be able to hear both the questions and the answers. There are lots of times we can shout. There are a few times we can have a dialogue. Let's take this half hour or so with pleasure. Your question, please, over here.
Mr. Secretary, in light of today's French air raids on the terrorists in Lebanon and yesterday's similar raids by Israel, what is the administration doing about the growing perception in this country and around the world that the U.S. is an impotent paper tiger in the Middle East and without taking decisive action against Syria and Lebanon?
Well, I think maybe I'll take this one over here.
See,
is that a little louder? Maybe this is a little louder. Let me try that. Perfectly reasonable question. Let me see what we can do with it.
Thank you.
There are two or three different things that can be done. One is straight revenge. One is straight retribution. One is an attempt to continue what we have been trying to do. I'll talk to you. You listen and I'll talk to you. One is to continue to talk to all the groups at Geneva and to try to secure at Geneva a broadly based Lebanese government which can have the ability to eliminate all of the terrorism that has taken place within its borders for far too many years. Terrorism against Israel, terrorism against France, the United States. So what we need to do is to try to define the most effective way to do that. Now, as you pointed out, two countries have taken that one path, Israel and today France, and they have made strikes against targets that, from which they firmly believe and which we concur, is where a great deal of the terrorism exists. Two nests of terrorism in that country. Our own policy has not yet fully matured, but what we are doing is looking at all of the possibilities. But mostly what we would like to do is to get Lebanon back to be a sovereign, unoccupied country so that it can prevent this kind of thing happening in its own borders.
If those of us who disagree with the Pentagon policy try to do it, and who can make the loudest noise, there's no doubt they got a bigger bang than we can make. In terms of our ideas being, if our ideas are better than their ideas, here is a chance to use ideas and questions. But we have a question over here.
Mr. Secretary.
Please, let your fellow class students.
Is this on?
Yes.
Mr. Secretary. By its continued massacre of civilians, the military government of El Salvador has demonstrated contempt for human rights. President Reagan claims to value human rights in his policy. Why, in light of the failure of his foreign policy to effect a change in El Salvador, has President Reagan failed to withhold U.S. military equipment, which is turned against innocent civilians without restraint? And in what sense can democracy be said to exist in such a setting?
Well, the... The weapons which have been furnished in El Salvador are weapons that are designed to prevent the construction of another Soviet base such as Cuba within the Central American area. And the fact that the Salvadorian government does need a very substantial improvement in every way, has to be measured against the alternative. And the alternative is the kind of government in which there are no human rights at all and no hope of any improvement. At least with the El Salvadorian government, with all of its faults, there is the hope that we can have the leverage to improve it. But if it falls to a guerrilla Soviet Cuban-inspired force, then we will have nothing but the kind of continuation of total lack of human rights that exists in Cuba and exists in Nicaragua. So what we're trying to do is improve the situation, but at the same time, make sure that it doesn't fall victim to the kind of government that is the negation of human rights.
Mr. Secretary, first, I want you to know that most of us here today believe in free speech, and some don't.
So do I.
My question, Mr. Secretary.
I do too, and that's why I'm here. Good.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My question. Do you feel that United States naval forces are being stretched thin around the world?
I didn't hear the beginning. Do I feel what?
Do you feel that U.S. naval forces are being stretched thin around the world lately? And if so, what should we do about it?
Well, we have the question relates to the naval forces and how thin they're spread. The problem is that we have a large number of commitments, and they are not conveniently all in one place. But we do have the plans underway to regain the degree of naval strength that we need. And I think that right as of now, if nothing further happens that imperils our national security, we would have a sufficient degree of force with the ones that are being added to deal with the situation as they exist. But it is essential to bear in mind that we have commitments in many parts of the world, and it is not really possible for us to give up those commitments without seriously endangering our national interest. And so we are acquiring greater naval strength. And by toward the end of the decade, we will have the degree of naval strength that we should have had, that we would not have had if we'd lost. So I think we're all right now, bearing in mind that we still may have to have a lot more activity that we would not choose, having a defensive philosophy. But I think right as of now, we are all right so long as we keep on growing. Thank you.
Secretary, we can keep going a while. It's all right.
For a second, we got a lot of questioners, so keep your answers short.
All right. Very good.
Over here.
First of all, Mr. Weinberger, I'd like to congratulate you and your administration for being ahead of your time. You brought us. You have brought us 1984, 1 year ahead of time. Mr. Weinberger, I note that you are a member of the Episcopal Church and active in the Episcopal Church. My question to you is, how can you reconcile your religious beliefs and how can you live with your conscience knowing that you are personally responsible for complicity in the genocidal murder of over 50,000 Guatemalan Indians, the murder of hundreds of Nicaraguans at the hand of CIA-funded counter-revolutionaries, the disappearance, the torture, the rape, and the murder of over 40,000 Salvadorians, and the recent illegal, immoral, and totally shameful aggression against the people of Grenada.
Okay. Well, the answer is, of course, that I do have a conscience. It is a personal matter. I have not really admitted, nor can I feel, that there is any complicity in any of the deaths that you recite. As a matter of fact, one of the most oppressed peoples in the world are the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, and they are people whose policies we are trying our best to liberate. So I have to tell you that my conscience does not bother me about what we're doing one bit. I think it is the right course to follow. But...
Thank you. You got somebody here? All right, quiet, please. Quiet, please.
Yeah, I don't mind free speech. I don't like cheap words, but I'll go on anyway. In 1898, the U.S. invaded Cuba. Since then, according to U.S. News and World Report 2 weeks ago, we've invaded more than 50 other times. Now, our legacy in the whole Central American Caribbean area is illiteracy, poverty, infant mortality, a kind of litany that if it occurred in a country where we lived, we'd be ashamed of it. And we can put up with it because it's over there. Now, the only countries that have changed that legacy are Cuba after 1959 and Nicaragua and Grenada. Now, I don't know if you've been watching the Vietnam special on TV, but don't you know that the entire third world, the whole UN voice... Yeah. How can this administration justify in the long term what it's doing now? It's going down to ruin like it did in Vietnam, and the sooner the better from my point of view.
Let me just answer one part of that. It is very easy for you to say that the entire third world feels this way, or that all the Caribbean is in poverty. There are two quick answers to it. The things we are doing, the Caribbean Basin Initiative, and three-fourths of all of the aid that we seek, are for economic improvement, to try to reduce the poverty there. But the important thing is, the last point that you made. And if you would talk, as I have, to over 500 of the students who were rescued from Grenada, you would find that they feel... You would find that they feel, not the way you do, and not the way you've expressed, they feel enormous gratitude, great appreciation, and because they had the absolute certainty, those 500 who paid their own way to come to the White House had the absolute certainty they were going to be taken hostage and that they were in imminent peril of their lives. And so, in direct response to your question, I feel very proud of what we did.
I think you will learn more. You can come over here. You can come over and shout by yourself sometime, but your colleagues and I cannot hear the secretary very frequently. We can hear you anytime. We have the next.
Everything is
possible. One more question over here, please.
Mr. Secretary, it's my understanding that components of the Rapid Deployment Force are also earmarked as replacements for NATO in case of trouble in Europe. If the Rapid Deployment Force is needed elsewhere, what are the contingency plans for reinforcements in Europe? And before you answer, I'd like to say there are a lot of people here who support the administration's policies.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much. It's a very reasonable and responsible question, and let's see if we can get an answer to it. The problem is that there are indeed, every one of our divisions, every one of our units has four or five different missions. Many of them are so-called earmarked for NATO. But if particular contingencies happen in other parts of the world where we have to respond, such as the British had to respond quickly to the Falklands Islands, then some of the NATO forces would indeed be drawn down. And what we are... What we are developing in the NATO is the attempt to work out the so-called out-of-area contingencies. And we have now a well-developed plan that still requires European consent, so that as forces are moved out, perhaps, of Europe to go to, for example, the Middle East or something of that kind, they will be filled in quickly. This requires, however, the ability to reinforce across the ocean and that requires that the sea lanes of communication be kept open. So all of this is tied together with our plans for an expanded fleet.
Thank you.
No, I was just saying, I applauded your idea for a moment of silence, but not for the cause. Let's have a question over here.
Goal of establishing. Mr. Secretary, even as you deny the rights of the El Salvadorians and the Nicaraguans, I think it's useful to look at what you claim is democracy in Grenada. Martial law has been established on Grenada that provides for arrests and searches without warrant, press censorship, and banning all public meetings. And a U.S. Army psychological warfare unit is on Grenada designing and putting up propaganda posters. Could you please explain how these activities are consistent with the supposed U.S. goal of establishing democracy on Grenada? And why have you sent an Army psychological warfare unit there in the first place?
First of all, and I know it will not be a popular response, we would have to deny that those conditions are taking place. What is taking place is the establishment of a new provisional government under Grenadans. There was a total degree of anarchy in the island, and what is establishing now is a condition to restore a government in which the people can vote on the kind of government they want. And in the process of doing that, it is essential that people who took part in the active anarchy and chaos that existed before we went in not be allowed to disrupt the establishment of a new provisional government. And that is all that is taking place. We had already said that we would have our troops out within 60 days, and after that the Grenadans themselves will decide the kind of government they wish. And we are not taking part in any of the activities that you describe. We're trying to establish a provisional government that can allow the Grenadans to set up the kind of government they wish.
Mr. Secretary, I have a question.
What are you saying? Make a question, please.
I'd like to ask a question, and to do that, I yield to the previous speaker.
Mr. Secretary, my question is, would you tell us, in the name of God, if not out of respect for the American public opinion, how many Grenadians died, and please don't forget to include the number of bodies you shipped to Cuba, whom your troops mistaken for Cuban troops, and those who died in the mental hospital. Please give us a figure as to how many Grenadians died as a result of the invasion.
I think the actual deaths on the Grenadian army were about 61, and I think that the civilian casualties were much lower than that, less than 10. On the Cuban side, they have all been announced, and the Cubans have all been returned, except for two Cubans who wish to stay in their embassy to deal with their embassy property. The hospital was not marked with a Red Cross. It was used as a strong point by the Grenadian armed forces. The patients in the hospital had people in the Grenadian army standing next to their beds firing out the windows, and our soldiers did not know it was a hospital until it had been actually, the buildings themselves had been taken. Had it been marked with the Red Crosses, it would of course never been attacked.
May I just ask the Secretary the total casualty figures, which we had...
I'll have to get them exactly up there.
I'll just...
You said there were 60...
61, the best of my
61 memory. Grenadians,
yeah.
And a dozen or so Cubans?
Oh, no, a few more, not many more than that, around in that range.
And
I could get them for you.
Americans.
Yeah. Less than 100. In that range, yeah.
All together.
In that range, yes. Yeah.
Next question over here, yeah. Please.
Yes, before I begin, I'd like to say that perhaps the people who are... Yeah. Perhaps the people who are interrupting would let him speak, because I think his own words will damn him to the hell he deserves. My question is, on the aftermath of the June 12th, 1982 rally in New York...
I really can't follow you at all, I'm sorry.
In the aftermath...
A little slower and a little further away from the mic.
Yes, in the aftermath of the June 12th, 1982 rally in New York City, at which approximately 1 million people attended, you said words to the effect that public opinion and such demonstrations of it would not affect American foreign and military policy. Now, I would like you to explain yourself as to how you can stand on that statement and on the statements you made earlier this afternoon about public opinion being extremely important. I cannot see how they can match.
That's a good question. We have a number of very good ways of measuring public opinion. And the best way is by an election. And all I was saying was, and frequently, you know, what you read and put back to me is something that I said is not a remark I actually made. But what was said was that the way in which public opinion is influenced and the way in which policy is made in the United States is by elections, by actions of the Congress in Congress assembled, and that no matter how many people you might get walking in the streets with signs, that is not the way our Constitution provides for the determination of policy. But I also said that those kinds of manifestations of public opinion are also things that help influence public opinion, depending on whether or not the people vote that way or Congress votes that way. It wasn't that they were disregarded, it was that you don't add up the number of people marching and change a policy the next day. We have our constitutional ways of doing that.
Right. I do want to remind you, particularly the woman with the red shouting so loudly, I do want to remind you that we have a guest here who we invited to engage in discussion. And you're entitled to stand in line, ask your question or others, but you are depriving most of us from hearing repetitive phrases and chanting. I myself believe, let me tell you where I stand. I believe that you will not be convinced by the Secretary's words, and you'll be armed better if you hear what they are. That happens to be my belief. But don't try and drown them out. Let's let some ideas come on. Next, please.
Mr. Secretary, the New York Times and several other sources stated that both the Grenadian and the Cuban government, before the invasion took place, requested that the United States not invade. Why did the United States invade? And if the purpose was to get the students out, why did they keep going after the students had been secured?
Well, there was no Grenadian government that could request anything. There was total anarchy. The prime minister, who was a Marxist, had been murdered. Five of his cabinet had been murdered. There was no designated successor. There was nobody that could speak for the country in any way. And so what happened was that the students, over almost 800 American students, were in two different campuses. And their safety was secured. Their safety was secured on the second day, but their safety was secured in the sense that the campuses were liberated. But you can't do just that. You have to get enough of an area to make sure that they are not subjected again to the kind of terror and fear that they themselves felt they were experiencing. And so we went on and completed the objectives, and now the process is there of turning the government over to the government of their own people's own choice, and not the kind of anarchy that prevailed. Over here. Getting tangled up in your wire.
Howdy. There have been several recent reports of thousands of Guatemalan and Honduran troops massing on their borders with El Salvador, apparently preparing for a large-scale intervention in support of the Salvadoran military. The Boston Globe, the New York Times, and many other papers have reported that so-called U.S. advisors in El Salvador are in fact making all major strategic decisions for the Salvadoran military. Given this, I would like to ask, how can you justify a possible invasion of Salvadoran territory by Guatemala and Honduras, regimes which have been described, for instance, Guatemala by Amnesty International as carrying out a government program of political murder? And how can you justify U.S.-sponsored regionalization of this war, which will ultimately involve U.S. troops being sent there to come home in body bags?
Well, there are no American advisors in Salvador that are making all the decisions. If there were, you would see a vastly different result than you have now. What we are talking about in Honduras is we are there at the request of the Honduran government to help train their troops. We continue to do that, but we are not participating in any way except to try to get a larger amount of primarily economic aid for El Salvador to reduce some of the great poverty that is there now.
People here who have a right to speak and to listen. It requires a certain amount of tolerance. Any society that wants to be a democracy entitles a certain amount of toleration. Next question over here, please.
President Reagan has gone on record as saying that the anti-nuclear movements in Europe are overly influenced by
the beginning.
You can't, President Reagan, we couldn't hear the question because of some of your...
President Reagan has gone on record as saying that the anti-nuclear movements in Europe are overly influenced by the Soviet Union. I'm wondering, is that a perception that extends to anti-nuclear activists in this country?
I'll try it again.
It's a good question. We didn't hear it.
Can I repeat the question?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite pick it up.
President Reagan has characterized the anti-nuclear movements in Europe as overly influenced by the Soviet Union, and my question is that perception extend to anti-nuclear activists in this country as well?
Yeah. Now, I think the question was whether or not the administration feels that the anti-nuclear demonstrations in Europe are all Soviet-inspired, and the answer is no, we don't. But what we think is that it is possible for the Soviets to help work on American or European public opinion, because that opinion is basically free to be worked on. There is no similar public opinion in the Soviet Union.
Two final questions.
That wasn't his question. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering if you feel that you have evidence that there is Soviet infiltration of American anti-nuclear activists.
The answer is not to any significant extent.
Your question, Clark, please, over here.
Mr. Secretary, you spoke of strategic alternatives being used in Europe, and you also spoke of the deployment of missiles.
Will you please be quiet?
It's really wonderful to see so many Americans using their freedom of speech right, considering so many Americans thought worthy to die of. As you were saying, you made a couple of points about the deployment of missiles in Europe and also about NATO and the United States feeling secure enough in Europe to bring the missiles back home. And I was wondering, how you can feel so secure when only 4 years ago we saw Russian aggression right there in Afghanistan.
What did you say? Was your question, it was about Afghanistan, but I didn't get quite what the question was. Would you just repeat just the end there?
It was just about, you were saying that NATO felt secure enough, and the United States felt secure enough to deploy missiles in Europe, correct? You were, in your speech, at least what I could hear of,
yes.
you were saying that we were developing strategic alternatives in Europe to make ourselves feel safe there, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What I was wondering is how you can feel safe enough in these alternatives when only 4 years ago, Russia went in and took over Afghanistan. How does NATO, why do they, I don't understand how they can feel so secure when their presence is obviously there.
I think your question is, why didn't we have a more effective response when the Soviets went into Afghanistan? Is that it?
Fine.
If I got it, can strategic weapons in Europe make any difference? If they didn't make a difference in Afghanistan, how can they make a difference in Europe?
Yeah. Let me say just two things quickly about that. That's a very reasonable question. The first is, the Soviets went into Afghanistan for two reasons. One was, they want access to the oil fields. It's the prize invasion route down to the oil fields. And the second is, they were convinced that nobody would take any kind of strong deterrent action against them. And that is one of the things that, one of the reasons, it's one of the things that happens when you allow deterrence to fail. If you had a strong deterrent and they knew that they would face a strong retaliatory action, I'm convinced they would not have gone in. That's what we're trying to do now. Go ahead.
Well, all I wanted to say with those missiles, they now know these missiles are gone. Aren't they going to have even more reason to be aggressive?
No, the missiles are the only reason for the missiles. The only reason for the necessity of deploying the missiles in Europe is to restore the balance. At the moment, the balance is 361 SS-20s to nothing, and it is necessary to restore that balance. If we can restore that balance, then we can concentrate much more on conventional warfare and conventional strengthening so that we can deter both kinds of attacks. The attack on Afghanistan is a conventional attack brought on because the Soviets feel they have nothing to deter them when they went in. They wish now they hadn't gone in.
That's your final question over here, please.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, fine.
The U.S. is involved in hotspots all over the globe. If nuclear weapons should get involved in any of these crisis situations, there could be as little, by Defense Department accounts, as little as 10 minutes in which to make a decision to launch the weapons. Too little time for the president alone to sufficiently think through the consequences of such an action. Now, are there certain crisis situations in which the president has pre-delegated the authority to use nuclear weapons? That is, in which the launching of nuclear weapons would proceed more or less automatically?
No, there certainly is nothing remotely resembling pre-delegation. And if you had sat in on the meetings as I did, all through the very difficult time as to whether or not we should take the action necessary to rescue the American students in Grenada, you would know how difficult these decisions are, and there's nothing remotely resembling pre-delegation. They're the product of very long and painful consideration of a number of factors, and the president finally... And the president finally makes the decisions by himself, and then we attempt to carry them out. And that is what we were able to do very successfully in Grenada. And I'm convinced that in later years, you will regard this as a very proud and proper chapter in American history. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary. Mr. Secretary, I want to congratulate you not on the wisdom of all your decisions, but on the way in which you've conducted yourself here. I would say that the...
And may I thank the majority of you, all of you, for your interest, and the majority of you for your behavior. Thank you very much.